off button. If I can have your attention, I think it's appropriate to get started now. My name's Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. I want to welcome you on behalf of our chairman, Jay Rockefeller, co-chairman, Susan Collins, and the other members of our board, to a briefing on how to move our long-term care system closer to the needs and the wishes of the people who are actually receiving the care. Our partner today is the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the country's largest philanthropy dedicated to improving health and health care in our country. The foundation has a long history of supporting efforts to improve long-term care. The president of the foundation is a geriatrician, by the way. They've also done a major project on examining possible changes in long-term care financing that you may have seen some results from earlier this year. Wendy Yalowitz from the foundation is in the audience just to make sure we don't take their name in vain. If you have questions about the foundation, about long-term care and their involvement, I'm sure she'd be happy to try to respond to them. The topic today is culture change, which may strike you as some sort of social engineering slogan. I don't know. And maybe it is. But there are profound policy implications as well. There are about 1.6 million Americans in nursing homes. There are 37 million baby boomers who will soon be aging into the territory when greater long-term care need is expected. Between Medicare and Medicaid, state and federal governments finance more than two-thirds of long-term care spending and almost two-thirds of nursing home spending. There's a good fact sheet, by the way, on some of the basic numbers of in your packets from that Georgetown financing project. One other number, about a third of those turning 65 in 2010, we expect to need nursing home care sometime in their lifetime, a third. But they're not looking forward to it. The image of today's nursing home is not a pleasant one, either based on the quality of clinical care being developed or the sense of control that people are afraid to lose once they enter a nursing home. And that's what the culture change movement is all about. You're going to hear about a bunch of ways that people who are committed to better long-term care are pursuing to make that care more resident-centered and less institutional and more home-like. And I think we've assembled just an incredible group of folks to help in that discussion. Couple of logistical items some of you may not have heard before. I mentioned the packets of materials that you have. There's a lot of background information. There's a good sheet on the backgrounds of our speakers, more extensive than the intros that I'll be giving them. Copies of the slides that, you'll be seeing up on the screen. By Monday, you can view a webcast of this briefing on kaisernetwork.org. A couple of days after that, you'll be able to read the transcript that will also be posted there and on the Alliance website at allhealth.org. And for those of you who are somewhat more in tune with the popular culture, there's a podcast you can download. In those packets, by the way, there are green question cards you can use. There are microphones that you can come to ask your question in person. And if I sound like a nudge, it's because I really like to be able to read your evaluations after this. And if you would do us the favor of filling out that blue evaluation form afterwards, you'll help us be able to respond to suggestions that you make to make our briefings better and of more value to you. So, as I said, we have a terrific group of speakers, and so turn your cell phones to vibrate and your heads to the front, and let's get started. And we're going to get started with Bonnie Cantor. Bonnie is the executive director of the flagship organization pursuing culture change in long-term care. It's called the Pioneer Network. her work at the Ohio State Medical School to make its graduates aware of the challenges of aging and long-term care have gained national recognition. And in fact, Ohio State's now known as having one of the top geriatric programs in the country. Now at the Pioneer Network, Dr. Cantor is bringing some of that same dedication to the task of changing the culture of the entire long-term care system. And we're very pleased, Bonnie, to have you with us here today to inform a Washington audience about that.
Great. Thank you so much. Can everybody hear me in the back and everything? Wonderful. Okay. Thanks so much for the opportunity to be here today. And since, as Ed said, I spent the last 22 years of my career in academia, I'm going to start with a question, which is, do you think there are more McDonald's in this country or nursing homes? Well, it turns out that there are approximately 4,000 more nursing homes in this country than there are McDonald's. Now, what does that mean? It means we've got a big thing to tackle right now, and if you're ever looking for a good statistic to quote, that is a fine one. The transformation of the nursing home is long overdue. The existing product that we have fails to meet the needs of frail older adults and the families who love them. Costs are high, and your communities and states struggle to support the existing model without compromising quality of care. So to address these quality and efficiency concerns, organizations are moving to find new and creative ways to what we call create home and community for nursing home residents while still providing the high quality care that a medically complex population needs. The bottom line is that in this time of rebalancing and unified state long-term care budgets, this culture change and the resident-centered care that results will be of great importance, not only because the philosophy is compelling, and I think you'll agree to that in a few moments, but because the business case in terms of quality and cost supports investment of change at the operational level and the policy level. And at the end of my presentation, I'm going to be focusing on some of the key things that all of you in the audience can do in your districts and states and federally to help make this happen. And the most important thing we can all do to make it happen is, can everybody see this? This is an easy button. Culture change right now is very complicated. Our goal here today is to figure out a way through policy and operations to make culture change the norm, to make culture change the default mode. And we're not going to be successful until...
That was easy.
We need you in this process. So I start with another question. Who here is aging? Please raise your hand. Look around. If somebody did not raise their hand, we will call the squad. When did you start aging? Well, I won't get into that debate, but it was sometime around birth. And where have you always lived since you started aging? You have lived at home, wherever home may be. And what you have here are some basic characteristics on your left of what home is and some basic characteristics of what lack of home or homelessness is. Why on earth in our communities in the year 2007 are we creating a cadre of homeless older adults, meaning folks who are living in nursing homes without the basic characteristics that we all want? Isn't that what your constituents want? They want to be able to say, are the values of choice, respect, and self-determination practiced here? And if we work together, the answer is going to be yes. And only then will nursing homes be the place where we would want to go to live or where we would want our loved ones to live. Part of the other reason to do this is what physicians tell us is that no matter how hard they work to help someone be healthy or more well, it will not work if they don't have a sense of community. We are bred, our genetic code is for us to live in community. The cavemen died out that weren't able to delegate. Somebody goes and gathers, somebody else goes and cooks. If you were someone who could not live in community, you didn't make it. If you take community and home away from our older adults, they will never be healthy. So what we are proposing is to take resident-centered adaptations that we will all be talking about today. We will show you, and we have research that proves, that improved quality of care and measurable financial success, both for states, the federal government, and our organizations, comes from this resident-centered care. And then what that provides all of us with is the opportunity to see efficiency and quality as interrelated outcomes, which means, again, to the bottom line, we should be reimbursing those organizations that can improve quality of care better than we are doing now. Now, one of the places you can turn if you are looking for assistance with this is the Pioneer Network. You have information in your handouts about the Pioneer Network. We were formed in 1997, and we are the ones, along with many others, who champion these values that we talked about to make nursing homes a place where life is satisfying, humane, and meaningful. And that movement is known as the Culture Change Movement. We are an umbrella organization. We are not a membership organization. We support the kinds of transformation we're talking about in a wide variety of ways. And to put a little plug in, we will be having our national conference. You all have this in your handouts. Here in Washington, we expect to see you all there. And so we'll be able to work even more closely together. But everything that needs to be done is not a federal concern. It's of state concern as well. So what you will find as you go back to your states is there are 36 active state coalitions that are independent. We helped organize them along with some others. Diverse stakeholder involvement. They are coordinated with other state efforts, and their responsibility is to help to get culture change going on the state level. What we also know is that there is no funding for these coalitions, and one of the things we are going to leave you with at the end is some questions about how we can fund them, perhaps through civil penalties money and some other innovative ways. So the key questions that I'm going to do with the remaining few moments that I have is to talk about what is resident-centered care, why we all want it, where we are now, and what's it going to take to make it the norm. Very quickly, I'm going to share with you a scenario that happened in a medical director's home in Cleveland, Ohio. Go Indians. I have to give a little plug there. Medical director was called in the middle of the night by the DON, and the DON was telling him about four residents who had fevers between 99.8 and 102.2. He had only one question for her, and the question was, why were you taking their temperatures in the middle of the night? And her answer was, that's when the staff has time to do it. In a nutshell, we are going to talk about why that was wrong and how resident-centered care will solve that. So what is resident-centered care? It's taking the proper health care and merging it with resident support based on a core set of values. We talked about those already, where choice, dignity, self-determination, and purposeful living. We respond to each individual's needs and desires, and then we create home. And creating home is what separates resident-centered care from all the other discussions of patient-centered care that you hear about in the acute care setting. There are many ways to talk about culture change, and of course we will be talking about some of the smaller living environments, the Greenhouse Project, the Eden Alternative, the Household Model, etc. But those are just markers for some of the ways that we go about doing it, including permanent work assignments. If you think about it, people who know the residents best will be able to figure something out very quickly. A flattened hierarchy, decision-making at the residence level, and dismantling routines and daily systems to allow for freedom and choice. Now, I'll bring this back to the level of all of us. If I woke you up before you were ready to go up, get up, or if I didn't feed you when you were hungry, fill in the blank, would you be grumpy? Yes. Would you be able to participate as well as if I let you sleep on your natural schedule? Absolutely not. If you don't believe me and you have a 2-year-old at home, try it with them. If you have a teenager, try it with them. And then ask them to go somewhere when they're hungry, especially somewhere they don't want to go. Need I say more? So what we know is that by providing resident choice by creating what we call normalcy, going back to people's natural schedules, we're going to get better clinical outcomes. The range of clinical outcomes is going to be broadened because we get it. We know how people will react, and the clinical concerns will be uncovered sooner. So what's it going to take to make this resident-centered care the norm? What do we all have to do? First, it's important to know that this is no longer a question. We have gone from debate to conversation. We all agree. The question is how. What we need to do is help everyone know it works, help everyone know that the business case is very sound from a state perspective and from an organizational perspective. You can secure resources, and you can do just as well, if not better, than the traditional care. What are the steps? Very briefly. First, we have to reframe the question. George Lakoff says to his students at Berkeley, don't think of an elephant. And as soon as he says to them, don't think of an elephant, now whatever you do, do not think of an elephant. You know what they do? They think of an elephant. And when we say to people, oh, no, no, it's not your traditional nursing home, this is different, it's culture changed, all people see is a traditional nursing home. So what we need to do is change the terms. We have to undo the debate and stop using other people's terms. So instead, we don't want to talk about the locus of care. What we want to talk about is values, the value of honoring the dignity of each elder and the staff members. And by doing so, many of the costly problems, both in terms of money spent and lives unfulfilled, will be addressed and eventually solved, and can be solved, we believe, within a 3-year period. We are also working with new organizations, which, of course, is part of the reason we're here today, folks that truly can make a difference in policy and practice. And then the next is we believe very strongly that we have to drill down and get into the educational system. People have to learn about this in our schools. They have to learn about it in the universities and in the training programs. And the last thing that we have to do, and I will be closing in approximately 2 minutes, is to promote the business case. You have to work along with us to help us explain that this is a very smart move for the states. It is a very smart move for the federal government, and it is a very smart move for the organization. Recent studies have shown this, and let me give you 2 brief examples. Here what you will see is non-adopters, those who have not engaged in culture change, and early adopter homes. And as you can see, from 1996 to 2003, there was a significant change in citations through surveys. Next, what you will see is what has happened to operating margin with the early adopter homes and those that have not undergone culture change. And as you can see, the operating margin over time for those that have undergone culture change is significant. Now, this slide says, for those of you that can't read it, if I don't think it's going to work, will it work? If you in this room do not think it's going to work, the answer to that question is no, it's not going to work, because we need some changes in policies and practices. Most specifically, as you will see in your packet, there is going to be a symposium that CMS is going to be doing along with the Pioneer Network in April here in Washington. We need you there. What we're going to do is work through either the perceived or the real issues in regulation that impact how one can deliver resident-centered care through the environment. We will then be drilling down and going back to the states, and we have hired an individual to help us work at the state level. Secondly, we are very firm believers that people that are not trained to do things are just not going to do them. Most of our Medicare dollars go into graduate medical education in the acute care sector in the hospital. We need to work together to ensure that some of that training doesn't just take place in places that are engaging in resident-centered care, but that the organizations that are providing that also get some reimbursement. And finally, as you'll see, many of our states have true issues with Medicaid reimbursement. They disincentivize resident-centered care. We can show you that if you apply these policies, folks will be healthier, acuity will go down, independence will go up, and as a result, reimbursement goes down. There is a disincentive to engage in culture change. We would like to work with you to develop waiver programs and to change the way we are reimbursing long-term care to encourage and not disincentivize resident-centered care. So with that, I am going to close and thank you so much for your attention. I look forward to working with all of you in the future so that we can create a more just and humane future for our most deserving citizens. I believe that as a society, we can do better. I believe that together, we will. Thank you so very much.
Thank you very much, Bonnie. We're going to turn next to Rosalie Kane, who's a professor of public health and a bunch of other things at the University of Minnesota. She's a veteran of other Alliance for Health Reform and certainly the Alliance for Health Reform's executive vice president's experience over the years. She's one of the most respected long-term care analysts in the country by far. She's looked carefully at some of these culture change models that Bonnie was alluding to, and we've asked her to give you some detail about them and the experience with them to go with the kinds of principles that Bonnie has laid out. Rosalie, I'm just so pleased to see you here on our podium here.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be on this podium. I didn't think I could be on it without having been elected to something or raise money for a campaign or something of that nature. Thank you all for being here. It's really wonderful to see this large a group. I thank RWJ for sponsoring this. It's a topic that's very, very close to my heart. And what I'm going to talk about will dovetail very nicely with what Bonnie has talked about. I was asked to provide some specific examples and then ultimately to zero in a little bit on the small house models and the greenhouse model of nursing home as one example of culture change. So that's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to show you some photographs along the way because a picture is worth a certain number of words. So as Bonnie already said, the goals of culture change, we're focusing now on the culture change within the nursing home, those places where nobody wants to go, are the improved quality of life for residents and the individualization that Bonnie talked about as a vehicle to get there, greater resident control and choice, continuity of the social life and the interests that the residents have. They don't just get born at the moment that they move into the nursing home, so they have a whole life. Some people have more of their family and their resources around them, but they do want to continue their lives in their larger community, but then there's also a need to create community within the nursing home. So we're working on individuality and we're working on community both in the goal of culture change. Hello? Shouldn't it? So there's probably could be many different ways of subdividing the approaches we would have on the ground. I think of sort of these four general approaches, and all kinds of specific actions can be incorporated under them. So we're trying to transform the physical spaces, the built environment, the equipment, the furnishings, everything about the design, because physical environments do shape behavior, the behavior of residents, the behavior of staff, the behavior of visitors. And that would allude both to the private spaces where people live. And when you think it over, if your private space just amounts to a bed and a chair in a shared room, you really don't have private space. And then the common spaces that are going to be shared if you lived in an apartment or in a neighborhood, there's always common spaces. So we're interested in both those environments. We're interested in transforming staff roles at all levels. That's a way to bring about those changes. And I'm talking about the professional staff and the line staff who don't always have professional degrees but are incredibly important in the nursing home. Transforming all the routines, the programs, everything that's done in a nursing home, and of course, transforming your philosophy. In terms of physical plant, there's such a wide range of things that can be done. I put private rooms and bathrooms first and foremost. Karen Schuneman, who's going to be speaking later from CMS, knows that I've been talking about that ever since the days of OBRA. I was on that little committee in 1982 and was very forceful in suggesting a recommendation that CMS immediately study the costs and benefits of private rooms for our different populations so we could determine whether as a regulatory matter we should be demanding private room and less by choice. And maybe about 15 years later, I got a chance to do that study. And indeed, we know about the power of private rooms and bathrooms. But then there's kitchens. You know, most nursing homes residents don't go anywhere near a kitchen. Even family members don't go near a kitchen. Kitchen, laundries, but fireplaces, you can read this. Getting it all down to residential scale. You know, you don't want to sit in a room like this to watch television. That's not a normal living space. There's been this movement into neighborhoods. One nursing home in Rochester, New York, in that area famously called it from hallways to households. You can see some really elaborate spas in place of the hideous shower rooms. I visited a lot of them, found some really awful stuff in traditional nursing homes. And removing nursing stations. They shouldn't be fortresses behind which the staff hide. Lots of things that you can do. In fact, the good news is that our nursing homes largely have to be rebuilt. We don't expect every nursing home to turn around and change their physical environment, but a lot of the nursing homes in this country were built in the 70s, in the 80s, some of them even earlier. So that gives us an opportunity to do different things. And these are all nursing homes. This is a fireplace in wood burning, which is a hard thing to get by regulations. Even greenhouses don't have wood burning fireplaces. Nice chair there, northern Minnesota. The reason why I have this one up is to show you a nursing station. I don't know if in the back or even in the front you can see it because it's only that little desk with the computer and a shelf over and above. And, you know, the 10 elders who live in this particular neighborhood in this nursing home, that's all you need. I've seen nursing stations that are concierge desks, all sorts of different opportunities rather than that fortress. And this one is just showing you an extreme. It's a part of Evergreen in Wisconsin, and this is a spa that actually has a fireplace. If we could see around the corner, we would see the shampoo bowl, the vanity table. You wouldn't mind spending time in that, a nice curtain. So that's the physical environment. In terms of staff, we've already heard about the idea of broadening and deepening the role of line staff. Universal worker is just a term that's used for that. Obviously, you have to make some kind of job descriptions. Nobody does everything. But the concept that people would be able to do a much broader range of activities because, after all, if somebody wants the newspaper, you wouldn't want someone to say, gosh, that's not my job. We'll have to send the newspaper aide over to get you one later. We talked about permanent assignment. I've seen the reorganization of shifts big time. For instance, where is it written that most of the action should happen between 7 and 3 of the weekdays? I mean, why might you not want more staff at different periods of time? And I've seen nursing homes where they don't even have anything like a standard shift. They have all sorts of different times for different people to come in. Now, I've reviewed all state nursing home regulations. Some of them get in the way of that. Some of them mandate the staffing ratios right down to the times of the shifts, and that would be a little destructive. And, of course, empowering staff is what it's all about. On the programmatic end, we have different ways of dealing with death, which used to be the dirty secret of the nursing home. You whisk out the body, hope nobody notices. None of the residents are supposed to get depressed or know that people are dying here. Lots of different creative work to change care routines. And in this package, you're going to find a lot of material. I applaud the Alliance for what they put together, because you can find resources on all of these things, bathing without battles, etc. And if you can't, send me an email about it. Putting care plans in the first person has proven to be powerful. So instead of the professional team writing it up, it comes up like I like to get up usually around about 10 in the morning, and I do like to read the paper before breakfast, or I'm a night owl, that kind of thing. The philosophy, we already heard about normality and emphasis on quality of life. Under this big tent, as Bonnie suggested, that is the Pioneer Network and is the culture change movement, there are lots of movements within the movements. And so a lot of you have probably heard about the Eden Alternative, and this notion of overcoming boredom, loneliness, and lack of meaning through the flattened hierarchies and other strategies, the least of which, though important, are animals and plants. The Wellspring Consortia is kind of an effort to improve quality of care through new kinds of alliances and planning teams. It's quite an impressive thing. There's lots of material about it. There are culture change agents out there, and I put some of their names at the bottom of my group of slides in case you want to go to their websites and see the kind of things they're doing. We've gotten to the point now where culture change is a bandwagon, then there are people who have real expertise in helping organizations move from A to not B, but to Z in the culture change arena. I'm going to talk about the greenhouse in a minute, so we'll leave that. Now, I hope you can read this, but perhaps you can't because my color coding doesn't work very well in a big room. These elements are elements of a good quality of life. Thanks to CMS and the lady on my left and others, I had the chance to work for a 5-year period to try to develop and test measures, first to determine what the elements of a good quality of life might be for people who live in a nursing home, and then figure out if we could measure them. So I'm here to tell you all these things are measurable. They're all outcomes as they pertain to the individual older person and living in the nursing home. The comfort and the sense of security are the most basic, and then we go up through the hierarchy. And it's very much like that lovely slide that Bonnie showed about homelessness in a nursing home. Let's go to the greenhouse. What are they? Some of you might have seen the movie that was playing in the background before you all got settled, and it's a very worthwhile movie to get a hold of and to look at. But it is a vision for a radically different deinstitutionalized nursing home. The idea was Dr. Bill Thomas, who also brought you the Eden Alternative idea. Essentially, the physical plants have been so transformed that they are small houses with no more than 10 people in them. Bill's original idea was 7. Each house is completely self-contained. You don't go into another part of the nursing home and it's another greenhouse. If it's not self-contained, it doesn't fit with the model. They are meant to be homes with all their symbols. The first architect said, you know, if you wouldn't have it in your home, we're not going to have it here. They had a little trouble with the exit signs and the fire marshals, and it looks a little silly to have a small living room and a lit exit sign on either side. But for the most part, they achieved what they wanted. private rooms are best for everybody, but very inviting public space if you want, including fireplace and a kitchen, a residential kitchen, and so on. And it's, the philosophy is completely transformed in terms of quality of life. And the other thing that's transformed is the organization of the staff. The idea is that the staff of these small homes, called resident assistants, if it's truly a greenhouse, they might use the word shabaz and shabazim, which were new terms that were developed. Shabazim is the plural of shabaz. For the nurse's aide level, that person is the one who's responsible for all the life of the home, that group of people. And then everybody else that regulations tell us what we must, that we must have in nursing homes, and that common sense tells us we must have, such as nurses, doctors, social workers, activities people, dietitians, therapists. They're all visiting clinical support teams that come to the greenhouses and help. That's the general model. So you have a community of the line staff and residents, the, who are usually referred to as elders. Those people do, those line staff, the shabaz, the shabazim, do have expanded roles. They do cook the meals. They do the light housekeeping. They do the laundry. This is really quite heretical when you think about our former and still present concerns about infection control and so on. So it is a dramatic change. And the last two things I want to say about the greenhouse in general is that it was expected to be done within Medicaid reimbursement. This isn't something fancy for the well-to-do. And I'll be very disappointed, frankly, if we achieve a huge extra added reimbursement for greenhouses, because it's my hope that we just redeploy and we do it within the existing reimbursement. We already have a natural lab in this country. Reimbursement rates vary widely. And the other thing is that it has to be done within the regulatory structure. The first greenhouses were developed in Methodist Senior Services of Mississippi in Tupelo, Mississippi. Does anyone else know what Tupelo's famous for? Who was born there? Right. Elvis Presley. I didn't know that till I got to go visit his home and everything. I'm not going to, there's material in the packet about the model, what they did in Tupelo. They had to work out the details of the general vision that Bill Thomas sketched. This is what a traditional nursing home looks like, what the one that people move to looks like. This is the greenhouse. This is the sign that used to be on the door of the old nursing home. If you can't read it, it says, please observe our visiting hours, 11 a.m. to 8:30 p.m., and the other sign says, welcome, on the greenhouse door. This is a move going into a residence, actual room. Where do you see sconces and a nice entryway, and this is their home in the nursing home. This is an old shared room. I love this picture because two televisions are on the same bureau because that's the only place they could put it. Now it's this is the new space. This is the lounge. The lounge. I'm going to. This is the dining and the dining. And if these pictures are put up, you'll be able to look at them at leisure. So that's what the greenhouse is like. They use the technology like lifts in order to enable independence. This guy has his bird, and then his bird goes into its house in the resident's own room. Now, we did very intensive research on this model, and it's all there for you to look at in the package. We did it for 2.5 years with the first four greenhouses that opened. We had two comparison groups. I promise you it was rigorous, and we hypothesized that the residents would have a better quality of life, greater satisfaction, quality of life on all those dimensions I listed, that the staff would be better satisfied, more empowered, that the families would be happier. And the bottom line is all those things are true. So I don't even have to show those slides. They're in your packet. All our hypotheses were confirmed, and also we used the minimum data set data and found that the quality indicators that are used standardly in nursing homes, they were either better occasionally in the greenhouse, they were no worse. This wasn't an intervention to change quality of care. It was an intervention to change quality of life. Now, what's happening now is that the National Greenhouse Project, funded, I'm happy to say, by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, is working vigorously to get more greenhouses in every state. And then we're seeing other firms doing small house nursing homes that are fairly similar in nature but without the trademark of greenhouse. And they're moving into ordinary neighborhoods instead of on campuses. And so it's extraordinarily exciting. We do have to work very hard at expanding and sustaining. Expanding is easier than sustaining. And that's where the pioneers and everybody in this room can help us, which is sustain the innovations. We have to work against culture creep. We can do against institution creep. And lots of training efforts. We do need to check out our regulations. This is one new greenhouse in Michigan, that's an ordinary house in a residential neighborhood behind. It's sort of the campus abuts that. And this is the new ones that are being developed, my last slide, in Perrysburg, Ohio. Otterbein Healthcare has decided that they're going to move their nursing homes into small houses, not greenhouses here, but small houses, and they're putting them in ordinary neighborhoods, largely neighborhoods for seniors. But that's a whole great shift. So I've enjoyed this lightning excursion through what's actually happening in the culture change movement. There's much more that could have been said. I wanted to make sure that my colleague Lois Cutler was mentioned since she took most of these pictures, and I gave you some other resources, including the Greenhouse website. And thank you. Thank you for listening.
Thank you. Thank you, Rosalie. Next, Jay Sackman joins us. Mr. Sackman's a consultant to the Service Employees International Union. He's been the executive vice president of the nursing home division of SEIU's Local 1199 in New York City. He's also been a key player in putting together a partnership between labor and management in the city to pursue culture change in nonprofit nursing homes. And we're particularly grateful to him for having rearranged his schedule in the last couple of days to be with us today. Jay, thanks very much for coming down.
Thank you very much, Ed. And can you hear me back there? I don't know if my microphone is on. Is my microphone on?
Yeah.
Good morning. And I want to thank you, Ed, and the Alliance for inviting me to be here this morning. And I want to also thank you for organizing the agenda this morning so that Bonnie and Rosalie came before me to frame the context and describe the vision for all of you of the work that we've been collaborating on in New York and hope to be collaborating on around the country. I actually just recently separated from the 1199 local in New York, where I had been for the past 40 years as an officer of the union and as a lawyer representing nursing home workers. And I separated from the union because I felt that there was a real need to spread the word around culture change around the country and help do some of the collaborative work that we've been doing in New York and other places around the country. How many of you are looking forward to the day when you can move into a nursing home? So that's pretty sad, right? And one thing that I know about public policy is if the public doesn't want it, they're not going to pay for it. And part of the problem here is that the public and the policymakers are not willing to invest new money in training and rebuilding the infrastructure of a very old system that was developed about 40 years ago with the enactment of Medicaid and Medicare. Something really needs to be done because many of us someday are going to have to move into a nursing home. Some of us are lucky. We have families who are going to take care of us at home. But some of us will have to move into a nursing home. And if we don't do something about nursing homes today, then it's just going to get worse and worse. We're worried about the collapse of the system. So, you know, one of the things that I know is that nursing home workers are just wonderful people. They do God's work. They love the residents that they take care of every day, but they hate the institutions that they work in. These are dehumanizing environments where people are stripped of their freedom and their dignity. Nursing home workers are supervised like they work in a factory. They don't have any input on the care plans of the residents. I mean, it's the opposite of the type of home-like environment that Bonnie and Rosalie were talking about that we would like to be creating for people so that they can move into a place that they can call home. So they're dehumanized institutions where there's no joy and there's no sadness. People aren't even given an opportunity to grieve over those people who they take care of. Something really needs to be done about this. And we have been doing something about it in New York. So let me give you a little bit of background. 1199 in New York represents 270,000 healthcare workers throughout the state of New York and Massachusetts and Maryland, and the Service Employees International Union represents nearly 2 million workers all across the country, many of whom are long-term care workers. We started pilot projects about 5 years ago in New York as a result of collective bargaining. Now, many of you know that typical labor-management relations are pretty acrimonious. There's no winners, no losers. We generally compromise on really important issues that we should be discussing, and there's very little chance for innovation or change in the workplace. And we've seen many industries die here in the United States because of the lack of initiative and leadership on the part of the union to move a change agenda in those industries. In New York, we were in collective bargaining in 2002, and the union was campaigning at the state and federal level for staffing ratios to improve the quality of care in nursing homes. And we were trying to bargain over wages and benefits and job security for the workers. And at the same time, the not-for-profit nursing homes raised the question of, well, why don't we talk about quality of care? Aren't there some things that we could be doing together? So we tabled this discussion about staffing ratios and tabled the discussion about quality of care for future discussions and created a table around which leaders of the union and leaders of the industry began the discussions about where we wanted to go with this conversation. Because we were all fed up with the situation as it exists in New York City, as you can imagine if you've never visited there. There are many nursing homes, and they're huge. They're the size of apartment houses. Some of them house as many as 700 people. So you can just imagine what the institutional environment is in places like that that were built in the 1960s. And people, everyone around the table felt that we needed to do something about that. So we started bringing in speakers, and we brought in literature to read. We learned about the Pioneer Network and the culture change movement that was taking place around the country and decided that we needed to move in that direction. And after a conference that we held back in 2003, everybody came up with the slogan that together we can create a person-centered culture. And we used our training fund and we used our labor management project, which are collectively bargained initiatives put together by the industry and the union, to leverage some of the resources that we had so that we could move the culture change agenda in 40 very large not-for-profit nursing homes, mission-driven organizations in the New York metropolitan area. So today, I think it's upside down. Good. Okay. I thought it said 2 minutes. I see it says 5 minutes. Okay. We have held 7 conferences. Now, one of the things that we did in order to leverage this was in the 2002 budget in New York, we campaigned for money for recruitment and retention because turnover in nursing homes is a very, very big problem. And it results in poor care to the residents because if the staff is not familiar with the residents that they're taking care of, you know, then the quality of care declines. And also for a layer of funding called quality improvement money that the employers had to apply for from the state to do training initiatives in the nursing homes. And we won hundreds of millions of dollars to help leverage this agenda in the state of New York. And as a result, we were able to hold several conferences and between the conferences do on-the-job training of the direct care workers and the professional and clinical staff and the nursing homes and used our labor management project, which does change management work, to facilitate the change process. And 5 years later, we have a lot to show for it. Now, we got a grant from the Commonwealth Fund a couple of years ago thanks to the support of Mary Jane Korn, to do a study of the work that we've done. And I want to go through this for just a minute or so, as I know that I don't have that much time, and I want to make sure that Karen Schoeneman has enough time to talk about her policy recommendations and the support that she's been giving on the Movement for Culture Change. So what they've decided, what they recommended is and this was going to be reported on the Commonwealth Fund website in just a couple of weeks. You'll be able to read the full report, which is really, really rich in statistics and anecdotes from the homes that they studied. Number one, that the management and the union have to work together. The workers and management have to work together on this, and they have to do so in large conferences. They have to do so in the workplace. They have to have labor management committees so that the workers have a voice in the change process. Number two, that there needs to be changes in the way the institutions are managed. And some of the recommendations that they're making based upon the studies that they did of some of the projects that were initiated by us is that instead of having nurse managers run the units, that you have community coordinators running the units. And some of those community coordinators can come out of the rank and file. They could be housekeepers. They could be CNAs. They could be social workers or recreational aides running those communities. But those communities are self-contained, self-managed. They do their own scheduling. They ensure consistent assignment of the staff to the residents, which is another thing that's a big link to quality of care, and that very, very important of all of this is that we move the food to the floor. Now you see in nursing homes, how many have seen people seen lined up in wheelchairs so that they can get to the elevator, so that they can be moved to the cafeteria where they can be fed their food. That is really an institutional environment, and I don't think anybody would want to live in a place like that. If we could move the food to the floors and have the self-directed neighborhood work teams work together on feeding the residents, we can ensure that the residents are properly nourished. On the union side, that there needs to be union support. The leadership of the union has to support this so that the workers who are represented by the union feel that they're covered by the union representatives and that they're not going to get in trouble for being what would be called class collaborationists, cooperating with the employers. When you dig down deep, what's interesting in this study is it showed that some of the barriers to culture change are the managers and the leaders of the union. But then when you implement some of these change processes, what happens is that the workers become much more motivated, and some of the things that they're saying in the studies are that, yes, I'm doing more work, but it's much more satisfying work now. Fifth, we have to make sure that we interview and assess the needs of the residents and the families of the residents in this change process. It's very, very important that the residents and the families have a voice in the change process. It can't just be what management wants to do or what the union wants to do. The residents and the families have to have a voice in all of this. And they finally start making some recommendations in the report that it has to be expanded into the whole home, the scheduling of the work has to be done at the community level, we had only initiated these projects on the day shift, and they should be implemented in the evening and the night shifts as well, and that we have to continue to find the funding both at the institutional level as well at the state and federal level to pay for the training that's needed and the backfill that's needed so that the staff can attend the training sessions so that they can learn about how to do this work. So it's been, very exciting for the past 5 years. We have a lot of successes to report, and we believe that we can replicate this model of change management in other places around the country. And we're looking very much forward to working with the Alliance and the Pioneer Network and with CMS and with other providers around the country and with state legislators also around finding the funding that we need in order to do the training so that we can change the way nursing home care is provided. And thank you so much for giving me a chance today.
Thank you very much, Jay. Last, we turn to Karen Schoeneman. She's a senior policy analyst and project officer in the CMS Division of Nursing Homes. She's in charge of CMS's efforts to promote culture change, including the joint conference that Bonnie was talking about with the Pioneer Network next year, about which there is a flyer in your materials. And Karen also agreed to join us at the last minute, and we're especially grateful for that. It isn't always as easy as it might be to get someone from CMS to come to an audience like this. So we're especially grateful for that. Karen?
Thank you very much, Ed. I'd like to thank the Alliance and RWJ for putting this on. I want to let the audience know, number one, I am at the worker bee level of CMS. I am not at the I can swing the agency to do what we'd all want level. But I'm at the level where a lot of work gets done. I want to let you know that I have been off work a month with a case of Bell's palsy, which means my face is paralyzed on one side. It is temporary, but you'll notice it affects my speech a little. So if you can ignore the lisping, I will try to speak a little slower than usual, although still come in the few minutes that I have, and tell you what's going on at the government. Yes, I'm at CMS's Division of Nursing Homes. We are the big, scary federal regulator. We are the ones who train the state survey agencies, and what I do there, I co-lead the survey process, and I specialize in quality of life. But I wasn't born there at CMS. Before that, I spent a long many years as a feisty social worker trying to get residents things they needed in long-term care. And I had my heart broken by the institution, by the institutionalization of the institution that said nobody can have anything special or everyone will want it. That sounded to me like a good idea. Give it and let everybody have it. But the institution just can't do it. In there, although it was set up for efficiency of the staff, it's not efficient. Nobody's happy. How many of you have been inside a nursing home? How many of you have seen a lot of happy people and a lot of hugging and loving and people knowing each other? How many of you have smelled good food? How many of you have seen what I've seen in the culture-changing homes? Cats in the middle of the hall, dogs walking by, ice cream sundae carts coming through, people who know each other, having snacks out of the fridge on their household. It's an amazing thing. I've seen it for my own self. I was lucky enough because of my role at CMS to be invited by wonderful Sarah Berger, who's here in red. Raise your hand a minute there. From the National Citizens Coalition for Nursing Home Reform to a very interesting meeting that happened in 1997 when Nickner, through their heaven knows how they did it efforts to push things in the process that are good, got together a bunch of people, 33 of us, innovators, and I was the only regulator, to find out about this new thing that everybody was doing to turn an institution into a home. And at that meeting, which was 3 days, they locked us up in a blizzard. They wouldn't let us out for any meals from 8 o'clock at night until 11 o'clock, 8 in the morning till 11 o'clock at night. We met, we fell in love, and we started a movement. So I have been with the Pioneer Network, which that group formed, and the movement now for 10 years. And so I was able to bring all this wonderfulness back to CMS and explain it to them, and the agency has gotten aboard big time, huge time. We are on this train, and I'll tell you why, because the OBRA law, the Nursing Home Reform Act provisions of the OBRA law, mandates, rights, dignity, meaningful activities, choices, quality of life, my stuff, my bag, my thing, the thing that I always wanted to get for the residents. But it wasn't happening. Institutions cannot make that happen. And now, these people who I was meeting had turned their places, even in old buildings that looked the way they all look, they had turned them into home. An amazing thing. And if you haven't seen one, at least take a look at the Greenhouse movie and take a look at some of the other videos that are out, but preferably go to one of these places because it feels like home. You've got residents who are so busy living life they don't have time to talk to you. You've got lively life going on. I've seen shootouts in an Alzheimer's unit. I had to fall down dead. And nobody was scared because the attitude had changed from let's keep it quiet, don't scare anybody, don't do anything special, keep the lighting low, blah, blah, blah. That's wrong. I have seen families be happy and say to me, I can finally go home and sit on the couch and not have to cry whenever I leave because my mother's hanging onto my arm and begging me to stay and take her home. But now she's saying, I am home. I got to go off to the harvest is in and the dogs need me and the little kids are coming by. Life has arrived in nursing homes. Now, is CMS on board? Yes, it is. Over these years, much, much, much has happened because we see This is the fulfillment, finally, of the Obra Law. We must have this. We are going to have this. And we need to make sure the feds and all the state survey agencies are not in the way of this. And they have been very good at being educated. I've done some of it. My colleagues are doing some of it. CMS has put out 5 broadcasts on culture change that are sent out to all the survey agencies. Providers can watch them. So we are learning, and then we are teaching. We are answering questions. Some of your handouts, I didn't do a PowerPoint show, are indications of what we're doing. We had a big Q&A letter that went out. People asked us simple questions that I thought were mind-blowingly odd that they had to ask them, like, can the staff and the residents eat together around the same table? How far have we gone into an institution where you had to wear a uniform, stand up, not sit down, and just shovel food, and you couldn't socialize? The answer was, yes, of course they can. That's like home, as long as people who need help get help. So the questions we're getting, and there aren't that many, for the federal requirements truly aren't in the way, are just they want to make sure that the surveyors aren't going to come and hurt them when they try to do this new thing. What else have we been doing? Well, you know, besides broadcasts, the Mississippi delegation, the 2 senators and several of the representatives wrote in, and the administrator put out a letter, which I wrote, actually. You know, I'm at that level where we actually write the things. I didn't say that. That was just a whispered aside.
This is all off the record.
Oh, yeah, I understand. But that letter's in here, and in the letter says what the delegation said was, is there any – we want UCMS to let the survey agencies know that greenhouses can qualify as nursing homes under all the federal regs. And so the letter says that, and then we threw in a few more things like, gee, we like culture change. Gee, we think we want to help out. Ask us your questions. Tell us what's wrong. We will help. Culture change has actually become, get this, institutionalized into the big institution of CMS in the government, not only among the survey and cert people that I represent, the regulators, but the payment people, the measurement people. Everybody's heard of it, the people that are developing the new MDS. They're all studying, learning, and trying to do something with it. We have it in the action plan, in the administrator's action plan. There's culture change projects. I've been doing some of them. The next one is upcoming, the one Bonnie mentions, which is in that gold. It's like a gold-colored handout. There it is, creating home in the nursing home, a chance for the public to gather to talk about the physical environment regulations, federal and state, and life safety code, which do not come from CMS, but we adopt them. They come from their own organization that's existed for 100 years. We wanted to have a chance. It's more like a hearing than a training. The regulators are going to listen. The public is going to speak. Out of that's going to come a workshop of invited stakeholders who can action plan a year's worth of work. What are we going to do at the federal level, the research level, the state level, the educational level, to make sure in the terms of the physical environment, people who want to build wonderful things are not being assaulted by old regulations that describe old-looking things. We're trying as regulators to put it together, to interpret our own regulatory language to say, yes, this is okay, and yes, that's okay, and be careful with this. I've seen actually a nurse passing meds with a cockatiel on her shoulder. I've seen amazing things. Things of home, you know? It's just an amazing thing. All right, let me see. I've got 2 minutes left. Okay. So we wanted to make sure that the states, the survey agencies, as well as the feds, you know, we have 10 regional offices of CMS, that we're all speaking the same tune. So we're starting to have some regulators forums by teleconference. And I just had one on Wednesday, and that was a chance for some of the states to present what they're doing with culture change projects. They're all out there speaking. Many of them are participating in these state-level culture change coalitions that Bonnie mentioned. But in addition to that, in some of the states, they're actually looking at their own state regulations and going to the legislature and saying, tweak the language. It's standing in the way of something. Now, that's coming from the survey agency who implements to the legislature who writes it to say, we've got to take account of this new thing here and make sure we are in favor of something that is better for quality of life. besides the regulators doing that, I'm hoping that everybody starts doing it and everybody notices things. Rosalie's got this wonderful website set up at the University of Minnesota, which lists all the state regulations according to the federal topic. So if you're looking handrails, there's the federal language. All the state ones are there now. That was never assembled in the history of the world.
The
Rosalie's got it now.
NHREGS+.
We can use that to see if there are some old regulations, mostly at the state level, that still dictate something that is not right anymore, like big old nurses stations. There are a few states that actually still have that yet. They don't need that anymore. There are some wonderful efforts because people are talking to each other, listening to each other, gathering together, and all saying, this works, let's do that. Let's get rid of the institution forever. And even though you may not have the money to remodel, once you gather your staff together, once you make, you know, how many of you are familiar with a nursing home that has like three wings and then a nurse's station in the middle? Maybe two wings and a nurse's station in the middle. Those two have become neighborhoods, two different neighborhoods. Even though that building looks sort of the same, they might break out a couple rooms to be the dining area and break out another room to be a living area. And that small group of residents and small group of staff get to know each other. And what happens? They fall in love. They get to know each one of you. Imagine two tables worth of you were now in a household and the staff just dealt with you. I would know that you like to get up earlier than you, and you like tea, and you like coffee, and you want creamer, and you want pie. I want pie. I want to go in the fridge at night and find something in there. I don't want to find what hospitals have. Saltine crackers, graham crackers, and green Jell-O cut into squares. That is not my preference. I want a Snickers bar. Let me order a pizza. Let's call the Chinese restaurant. Do they deliver? I want to pet the dog. I want the children to come by. It's all happening, and we can all make it happen together. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Karen. Let me remind you that we have microphones that you can use to come up to and ask a question. I know there are some people here who are from the nursing home industry or from state regulator organizations, and I'd particularly like to encourage you to comment in one way or another or question our folks in one way or another to clarify some of the points that might otherwise go unclarified. But let me start, if I can, with a couple of the things we were talking about before the program started. And conveniently enough, Karen has both Karen and Rosalie have mentioned it. And that is the question of the barriers to this kind of cultural change that either exists in people's minds or on statute books or regulatory agendas that stand between where we are now and the kinds of vision of a culturally changed long-term care system that we've heard so much about. Karen, you asserted that there really wasn't much in the way of a federal barrier. And Rosalie, you talked about the survey that you've done and now the website that the survey results are encapsulated on, about what's still a barrier in the state level. And I think we could very much profit from hearing a little more about that.
Well, let me, Karen, I'm sure, has something to add. I would just say that Karen is correct. The federal regulations are lean. They're not particularly specific except in a few areas around certain kinds of assurances that are needed. They're mostly very short. Most of the variation in action is at the state level. I've been reading all the state regulations and everything now. And yes, there are some states that say that you can't, that staff can't eat with residents. There might have been a reason for that sometime, but probably that has to be changed. There are states that say the bed can't be pushed to the side of the wall, though that was changed by statute in the state of Florida. So there's a lot of variation. The word nursing station does not occur in any place that I could find in any federal regulation, but states can go on for pages and pages about how many people to a nursing station, what the visual field should be, what the distance should be, and so on. So there is a lot of detail at the state level that needs a little bit of fixing, and some of the fixes have to be to support preferences and to support loosening up the way we do things with workers.
And let me just reiterate something that you said, but you didn't have your microphone on at the time, and that is the URL for your website is at the end of your presentation.
Yes.
And the hard copies that you have. Karen?
And the federal regulations don't have much in them that's wrong, because what they have is residents. Here's my favorite federal regulation. Residents should have, and I'm not going to give you the exact language, residents should have a choice over their schedules, their activities, and anything else that's important to them. That's been in there since the passage of the original OBRA regulations, which went into effect in 1990. A choice over schedules, what time you get up and go to bed. Well, guess what? They haven't had one yet, except in places that are changing their culture to accommodate it. Because if you do that, you have to figure out, how do the meals get served? How did the bathing get done? What about the shifts who come in? When is XYZ done? What about medication and med pass? But they figured it out. So the federal regulations support culture change. There are a couple things I don't like, only a couple. Maybe there is actually still one that says it's okay to put four people in a room. Oh, please. That's a real antique there. How many of you want to live with three strangers who have unusual habits at night? We'll say.
How about two or one?
Even one, yeah. But the state regs, as Rosalie mentioned, that bed up against the wall thing, you know, all these regs come from some problem. Somebody went to their legislature or to the feds or to Congress and said, here's a problem, stop it, write something. And so they all came from something. But in many cases, the people that wrote it and had the problem, they're all dead now, and nobody knows why that language is there anymore. And now it's time when you can say, we don't see a reason for that anymore. And so the state coalitions can take Rosalie's website and go, look, our state's the only one that has this language. That's kind of stupid. Let's go to the legislature, knock on the door, and say the other 49 states don't have that. We can get all the remaining few things out of the way and make sure the surveyors don't have, like, attitude problem of their own, that they think something needs to be that way because they were trained that way in their own training as professionals that happened 30 or 40 years ago.
Bonnie, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I want to add that in the culture change movement, we have a great deal of respect for the state and federal regulations and standards. And by no means does anyone want to lower those standards. It's a different approach to meeting the guidelines. And I'd like to give you just a quick example of how one can abide by the regulations and ensure the highest quality of care and quality of life. If we have somebody in a nursing home who has diabetes, which is a very common occurrence in a nursing home, and that person is decisional, doesn't necessarily have decision-making capacity, but as that chocolate cake goes by, they know they want it. Now, culture change would never say, the culture change movement, we will allow that person's blood sugar to get out of control and lower their health status because they wanted that cake. So I want to make sure that everyone knows we are not compromising someone's health. But since we understand the connection between emotional health and physical health, we will figure out a way for that person to get some cake. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I want to use this as an example, and it's one that Karen is very familiar with as well. So what would we do that would abide by the regulations and let that person be happy? Because as we said, if they're happy, they're going to be healthier. Quality of life and quality of care are intertwined. The entire team would need to get together and know that Mrs. Smith wants that cake. It's coming today. So for the entire course of that day or part of that day, someone will have been checking her blood sugar, making sure it is at a point so that she can have that cake. Then afterwards, everyone's going to do a little more work. So this builds on what Jay was saying. Nobody wants to do less work. No one even wants to do the same amount of work. They want to serve the resident. And so if it means doing some additional blood draws, to make sure that after she had that cake, she's going to be okay. They're going to do it, and they're going to happily do it because they know Mrs. Smith. I think that's what I called her, very well. Now, the most important thing there is that the care plan has to indicate that that's what they're going to do, so that when Karen's folks come through, they're going to understand that, you know what, sometimes her blood sugar might be a little off, but we have a plan to take care of it. We are not going to compromise her health, but we're going to respect her desires in the process. But the care plan has to be able to indicate that. We will never accept lowering her health status because of what we want to do. Instead, we work with the entire team to make sure that we respect her and we keep her health status where it should be or increase it because she's happier. But it takes a little extra work, and people are very happy to do it. And it takes satisfying the regulations. We would never ask for anything less.
Thank you, Bonnie. There are several questions here that have come up on cards. I'll try to weave them together, and I suspect that at least a couple of them might have been evoked by your picture of the Oshkosh fireplace, spa. And they all involve how much money this is going to cost. Is it possible to design a long-term care system that spends the same amount of money as we do now and yet is consumer-friendly? This person wrote to Greenhouse and said, give me some data on how it works as a business model, and didn't get any response. That really is kind of a central question. Can you do this on budgets that nursing home operators in almost every state are complaining are inadequate?
Yes, you can. If there's going to be new capital costs, one has to look at that separately, of course. And the capital costs of constructing the greenhouses, for example, is actually less than it would be to build a new nursing home in a big box or to renovate one. There's been lots of studies about private rooms and bathrooms. That's slightly more expensive in capital costs and way cheaper operationally. So we do know that it's cheaper to run the nursing home if people have their private space. The fireplaces were a little over the top. My husband looked at that and said, would you spend your next dollar, on the fireplaces in the spas? And no, we probably wouldn't. That happened to be a rather well-endowed place that is a model for all sorts of things. But yes, it can be done, and I think it can be done through redeployment. The greenhouses themselves have pro formas now. I'm sure Wendy can help you with that, and there's material on the greenhouse website that show how you can make the financials work. It'll be a little different in each state, but you plug in the information and you can make it work. There isn't just one only way to mix and match the staff, but it can be, but they have one way up there that shows that it can work.
Okay. Bonnie and then Jay.
I have a one-word answer that's going to take me a couple minutes to get out. Turnover. I don't know what the turnover is in some of the organizations that you are used to, but on frontline staff, it can be well over 100% a year, correct, Jane? When you undergo culture change, it has a dramatic impact on the work of the frontline staff and turnover. And so when we want to talk about the business case, you have to look not at silos, but at the business model in general. When people get up when they want to get up, and if I polled all of you, some would be 8, some would be 6, there'd be someone who wants to get up at 5. And then we translate that into, then when do we need our staff here? And all of a sudden we realize that a quarter of our staff could get here at 8 o'clock, which means 6 additional people can say, well, wait a minute, you mean I could get my daughter off at the bus? And she's so happy to be working there. And someone else could say, well, if I got in here at 5, you mean I could pick my daughter up from school? Yes, you could. So what we see are staff that are very happy and who stay much longer, so turnover is less. And now you think of marketing budgets and advertising budgets and all of those good things. And care goes up because you've got the same people caring for the individuals, and so it takes much less time to give the bath. Agitation goes down because they know how to give the person the bath, and so the person doesn't leave, because bathing and agitation is a key source of folks saying, I've had it. And so you have to not look in silos to see the business case, and you realize that if you take that one thing, turnover, you can eliminate so much unnecessary cost, and your quality is going up at the same time. So absolutely, the business model is extremely sound.
Jay?
I've been, for the past several years, responsible for over 200 nursing homes in the New York metropolitan area. And some of them look like Holiday Inns and resorts, and others are very old buildings. Culture change, to some extent, can make a place look better, but it's not about that. I know of one nursing home on Long Island that looks like a Holiday Inn, and yet it has rigid schedules, and there's no freedom whatsoever, mm-hmm. As opposed to another nursing home in New York City, which I will name, Greater Harlem Nursing Home, that has very little money to spend. But there are self-directed work teams. Nobody says, that's not my job. Everybody works together. They're very personal with the residents. And the staff love going to work every day. And they do create a home-like environment, even though no money has been invested virtually into creating a different look. So it's not, it could be about that. That can drive some of it, removing the nursing stations, creating nicer bathrooms, creating a nicer look paintings and wallpaper and carpeting, and making it look more like some of these very pretty homes that were showing up on the screen. But even in a place that doesn't have any money to invest, you can create a person-centered culture where people feel like they're at home.
Yes.
Very good. Actually, Jay, let me take the occasion to ask you a couple of the questions that have come up on cards that are different sides of the same coin but are related to the question of staffing that both you and Bonnie were talking about. On the one hand, someone asks, how difficult is it to deal with the resistance from nursing staff to make these changes? After all, you're turning over what had been considered professional responsibilities to untrained or lesser trained staff. On the other hand, someone asks, or observes that nursing homes are one of the most regulated industries in the country, and wonders if you actually did say that 1199 got a waiver to allow the reformulation of staffing models.
Well, I didn't say that we got a waiver, but I'll talk about we have invited Keith Service, who was in charge of survey and inspection in the state of New York, to every single one of our conferences. We keep him plugged into every change initiative that we're working on in any of the homes. He talks to the survey team. So we've done a culture change in the survey department in the state of New York to sensitize them to some of the experimental work and some of the innovations that the homes make happen. So, no, we didn't get a waiver, but we have worked with them. And so when the survey team comes in and sees something different going on, they know what it's about, and they've been given advance notice of it. I will say there's just as much trouble, and I'm going to be honest with you. I hope you would want me to be honest with you. There's just as much trouble dealing with nurses giving up control as there is in the union organizers giving up control, and the union delegates or shop stewards giving up control over work rules. There's resistance on both sides. And I think that, instead of dealing with the resistance head on, what you need to do is show some leadership and bring people back to why we're doing this. It's about the values of person-centered care. That's what it's about. It's about the residents. It's not about my turf, your turf, You know, and eventually people in any kind of organizational change process, you're going to find layers of resistance and people not wanting to give up control. The nurses have been a problem. Social workers have been a problem. The unit directors have been a problem. And on the other side, the union sometimes is a problem and doesn't know how to approach a problem in a way that where we can solve the problem together. So we've done a lot of training on interest-based problem solving. We get all of the managers in the room and all of the union people in the room, and we train them on how to solve problems together.
Bonnie, you want to?
Yes. Very quickly, I think that when I say very quickly, I don't mean it. You've learned. One of the benchmarks of the culture change movement is the phrase person before task, and we haven't used that yet today. It is the cornerstone. Part of the problem isn't that these individuals are the problem. Part of the problem is we in our communities are not educating and training folks in a way that facilitates this kind of care. So that if in our nursing curricula we are training folks to be task-oriented, it's not their fault when they come into the nursing home that they're trying to do their tasks. They're doing that which they were told to do. And I want to point to an example, not from nursing, but we've got right over here Randy Lindner. Randy, do you mind? Randy is the head of the National Board of Nursing Home Examiners, who really sets the tone for much that is going on. And in the next iteration of the job description for nursing home administrators, and again, this is still in draft form, so this is not an official statement, and I don't work for NAB. The nursing home administrator is now going to be responsible for ensuring resident-centered care throughout his or her organization and will be held on both the exam and in the coursework and everything else they do to ensuring culture change throughout their organization. So if you're going to get a job in a nursing home, your administrator in the future is going to insist that you do this because he or she is going to be held responsible for it. So from the top down, we've got a perfect example. This is not how nursing home administrators have been trained in the past, which means we can do the same for physicians. We can do the same for nurses. And Randy, who has both national and state responsibilities, sets a really good model for that.
Very good. Thank you. Before we go to the floor, let me just say we have about 10 minutes left for questions. We have more cards than I'm going to be able to throw at our panelists. So if you really, really, really want to get your questions asked, you'll do the way Sarah has done and come to the microphone. Would you identify yourself, Sarah?
Yes, Sarah Berger with the John A. Hartford Institute for Geriatric Nursing, New York University. I coordinate a coalition of six geriatric nursing organizations across the country, most of whom are working in long-term care. And they are very interested in this. My question to you, and it's kind of a perfect segue from the last remarks that were made in the interesting question. Rosalie, I think you were the one who did the assessment of the Tupelo, Mississippi group. And one of the things you found was that the quality measures, the national quality measures, were either the same or slightly better. And as someone who knows a lot about those quality measures, it doesn't give me great comfort to think that they weren't stupendous and wonderful. My question is, how can we coordinate these two issues of quality of care and quality of life? They're still going on separate tracks. Somehow, and I'd be glad to help you in any way I can with the 20,000 nurses that I communicate with, we've got to get them integrated. So my question to you is, what are your plans? How are we going to improve that and see that the clinical quality improves?
That's a great question, Sarah. I was actually thrilled that because I heard so much background noise about you can't do this, you can't do that, the quality is going to get worse if nurses aren't doing A, B, C, D, E, and it didn't. But you are right. It's an extremely good question. I want to just say one word about the previous one, which was in the Tupelo implementation back to RNs and licensed staff. They were at first quite resistant to all the changes. It was partly because so much attention was put into the training and the empowerment of the CNA level person that everybody else, including the nurses, felt they had no role. They suddenly found a brand new role that's very exciting in working in collaboration and on the ground training, and it made a big difference. As far as putting the clinical, my husband is wont, who's a geriatrician, is wont to say that nursing homes don't have, they're not homes, they don't have nursing. That certainly used to be true once upon a time. And in order to really deal with the chronic disease management that we need to see, both the management of chronic physical problems and of chronic psychiatric diseases, we do need to have information systems, we need to have triggers, we need to have a proactive kind of management. Medical directors and attendant physicians have to be involved. Line staff need to be taught how to make observations, and there is some exciting work going on in some of the nursing homes that are dedicated to culture change to also create sort of transforming ways of doing the healthcare. I think you triggered an important issue.
Go ahead, Bonnie.
I think that, Sarah, you're right on target, that neither one can be left behind and they must be put together. And I think that part of this has to do then with how we evaluate success, as you indicated. And I want to, again, because I like to teach through example or talk through example, if you think about consistent assignment, which enhances quality of life, because we talked about community getting to know each other, and we deschedule something like going to the bathroom, I think what we will find is that quality of life and quality of care coincide, and I'm going to take that one step further. With consistent assignment, the frontline worker truly knows when somebody needs to go to the bathroom. They know their schedule. So we have deschedulized. It's not going at 2 and 4 and 6. It's when that person needs to go. Because we have done that, we've done a number of things. One, we've probably prevented a potential fall as the individual tries to get up and goes to the bathroom. We've also made that person feel an awful lot better because they haven't had accidents, and they may be going down and going to more activities now. We also are preventing a certain number of UTIs, urinary tract infections, and we are potentially impacting the survey process and, more importantly, the prevalence of decubiti. These are the kinds of examples, the things that we have to be focusing on is where quality of life and quality of care coincide and where we can measure both. Because if
without disagreing, though, there are because what Bonnie's saying is true, I think that Sarah was bringing up issues that have to do with the kinds of meds that are given, the prescriptions in the first place. I mean, there's a lot of room for healthcare writ large, and I think that's where we bring the two systems together.
Okay. We have someone who's been very patient at the back microphone, and while she asks her questions, I will add a question, I hope, actually. I will ask you to pull out those blue evaluation forms, and you can, if I can be so presumptuous as to characterize it as this, evaluate success as we have just heard about. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I'm Alice Head. I'm the executive director of NICNR. And as Karen pointed out, the culture change movement was birthed in our organization. And I want to commend the Alliance for having this meeting because we need to be talking about this in this country. And our concern at NICNR is that we know culture change works. We know it's what consumers want and families want and residents want. If you go to our website, last week was Residents' Rights Week, and we have hundreds of statements from residents and artwork depicting what they want and in terms of quality. And what they're saying is that they want resident-directed, individualized care. Our concern at NICNR is that the nursing home reform law is 20 years old. We're going to be having an event on Wednesday looking back here in Dirksen at the nursing home reform law and why these changes haven't come about in the 20 years. So I guess my question for the panelists here is, what would you say needs to be changed so that we can have culture change for the 1.7 million residents in nursing homes?
We probably all would say something different, but you know, because there's a lot of things that need to be changed. The statute, the Obrist statute, is 20 years old, and while it calls for complete, you know, maximum physical, psychological, and social well-being, there's a lot of vagueness in the goals. And then we get into the specificity around the details, and there's a huge movement towards safety in this country, correctly so, because of scandals in the hospital world. I think we're going to have to accept that people are going to die. They're going to die in nursing homes. They're going to die out of nursing homes. They're not going to die in metabolic balance. So that we can't have an attitude that we're always looking for who to blame with each mishap. And we can't get to the point where we're going to consider it an error any time a person is walking in a nursing home and breaks their hip. If we call that a medical error, that is a problem, because it's not a medical error when someone's living at home and breaks their hip. So there will have to be quite an attitude change. Much as I love Oprah, there are contradictions within it, and then what's going to take priority.
Jay and then Karen.
So we need somebody like Al Gore to talk about the next problem, which is the real 800-pound gorilla, you know, in the room here, and that is the workforce problem. There is going to, just in another few years, there aren't going to be enough workers, nurses, CNAs, to do this work. And nobody is doing anything about it. And the opportunity, you know, we have to grapple with this opportunity right now, because if the funding was available to motivate high school students to do this work, and if we developed training programs that were centered around person-centered care, we could change the system from the bottom up at the same time that we're doing things on the regulatory level, at the same thing that we're saying, it's at the same time we're moving this movement at the institutional level. But something has to be, this is the biggest problem that's out there. We can talk about recreating, you know, creating home, but if there aren't enough workers to go around, you know, and yes, maybe the problem will be solved by people coming in from the Philippines and from Africa and from India and from the Caribbean countries. But is that what we want? Don't we want to take care of our own elders here in this country? We need to do something about the workforce problem.
Karen?
Since the movement is called Culture Change, and hi, Alice, it's nice to see you. I didn't know you were there in the back. I'm thinking that the next phase is when people are confronted with a brand new idea and they don't quite know how to do it, they fall back on their education. And I'm seeing now the start of the development of education for the professionals, administrator, medical directors, RNs, LPNs, aides. I haven't seen it come for social workers yet. It's starting to come to activities to train them from the beginning in a culture-changed way of person-directed care so they don't have something to unlearn. Unlearning is really hard. It's like that don't look at the elephant. You know, don't think about an elephant. And I'm thinking the surveyors need to get some re-education too, because most of them, like me, were trained a long time ago. I've had to unlearn institutionalization and everything from what I think is good, like Rosalie says, and I agree with you, you know, the quality measures and indicators make some assumptions that certain things are good and we shouldn't have these things and we should have those things. And we have to do a national dialogue on what is good. But in terms of the education of the Institute for Caregiver Education, which is a culture change training organization up in Pennsylvania, they're just about getting it ready to start the first that I know of in the nation, an LPN school that is teaching the LPNs from the beginning, their whole LPN education, in a culture-changed way. They've already got nurse aid training going that way, and that model of that school curriculum can then be passed around to others. That's just one. The LPNs are key in the who has the power in nursing homes. The same thing is happening with Bonnie's project with the medical doctors and medical education. Once they go out and get trained in geriatrics in a culture change setting for their practicum, they'll see, oh, yes, we can do it this way. I think the educational part's important now.
I agree with Karen about the education. Of course, through the Commonwealth Fund, we are going to be able to affect how both medical directors and undergraduate and graduate medical education is staged and culture change. However, the one thing that I would like to add to the, in response to Alice's question of what will it take, to be bold and blunt, we don't value older people in this country. And until we value older adults, we will not be valuing those who work for them. And it will take a bit of a mindset. So in my mind, 20 years is not a long time on that journey.
Randy, if you have a quick question that we can get a quick answer to.
Okay, great. I'm Randy Linder. I'm president and CEO of the National Association of Boards of Examiners of Long-Term Care Administrators. Building off of Jay's comment about the workforce, we've been very concerned. We can do, and we are very committed to enhancing the leadership of administrators and preparing them for a culture change environment. However, over the past 10 years, we've seen the number of people coming into the profession shrink by over 40%. And right now, we're probably bringing in 1,000 new candidates a year into the profession at best. That's it for the licensure examination. And we know that not all of those are going into nursing homes as an administrator of record. Some of them are going into assisted living. Some people take the examination because they're maybe in a senior corporate position or they're in an academic setting and want that credibility. And part of the problem is the perception of the profession, and it has the same stigma that nursing homes in general have. And if I were to turn around to this audience and ask how many in this room are thinking of aspiring to become a nursing home administrator, I'd probably get as many hands as those who want to live in a nursing home. Or if I were to ask how many are advising their children to become administrators as a profession of choice, it would probably be the same. I'm wondering what, and maybe I direct this question to Karen, as part of OBRA, there were proposed nursing home administrator standards at that time, and they just somehow got lost, I think, with many of the other things that were on ICFA's plate at that time. And as a result of that, we have a lot of barriers that make it difficult for people to come into this profession or to move between jurisdictions, and it's because we have federal regulations that mandate licensure, but then it was left up to the states to establish the standards. And so they range from high school education to baccalaureate degrees, specifically in long-term care administration and training programs, from 0 to 2,000 hours. And so we have a hodgepodge mess, and we're seeing the same thing develop in assisted living in that profession. Is there anything CMS could do to help us?
Is there anything they can do? Well, I'll tell you, there isn't anything they are doing that I've ever heard, and I've been there 17 years now. So I came in sort of with OBRA. I came in 1989, and I've never heard anybody say anything. Nobody's ever put the word administrator and standards together in a sentence in front of me there. Is there anything they can do? I think CMS is really, we are the implementer. We're not the originator, and we seem to be really into federalism, which to us means leave some things to the states that can be left to the states. Since I just work there, I'm not even going to tell you what my opinion is of that. Who cares, what I think. But I think that's why you don't see anything coming in terms of standards for any of the professions. So your work is either going to be to change the federal attitude or to just work at the state level to get more consistency.
And I probably would choose the latter. I do understand the issue, and there are quite a few states that require only a high school education. And this is multiplied across all the professions that there is various variation in standards. I do do think the nursing home as we know it, to coin a phrase, is a dinosaur. I don't think that 20 years from now we'll be exactly talking about nursing homes like this. I think we'll have some sort of merging of what we now call assisted living and what we call nursing homes. We'll still need somebody to administer this entity, though, so I the question is, do we want the requirements to grow out of the job as opposed to a bunch of educational standards that will become anachronistic? I want to say one thing about the first question Alice asked, too. I think that what we need is a civil rights movement in relation to older people, the same thing that we have with younger people with disabilities, that where we haven't said these are people who need services, they have care needs, they need a care plan. We're saying these are people who have disabilities, and every single person in a nursing home qualifies as having a disability that would qualify under the ADA. They need accommodation. And I think we're going to find them getting their accommodation all over the place for their disabilities, fewer and fewer in nursing homes. So maybe we won't, Randy, we might not need as many nursing home administrators in the future, but we will need administrators for whatever the grand new model is. I think we'll have to think together what that will be.
Well, thank you. We're going to have to draw this to a close. Just a couple of loose ends here. We will, the good Lord willing and the bandwidth allows, post the pictures from Rosalie Kane's new presentation on our website with her slides. And if we can figure out a way to do it, we'll even put the movie on there, too. Alice mentioned the, not only OBRA in general, but the fact that they're going to be doing a program on it next week. And I want also call your attention to a program that we intend to be doing on the Hill on December 5th, taking a look at OBRA 87 and looking forward about the issues that you've just heard discussed. We're really talking about reforming nursing homes in America. Everybody along this panel, a lot of you out in the audience, they are in fact very really pioneers in this movement, and you might say that you're trying to reform the nursing home industry in this country 10 beds at a time or 7 beds at a time under the original vision. One thing we know is that it's a huge task, and we're going to have to enlist a lot of people from a lot of different political viewpoints and ideological viewpoints into making that happen. Thank you all for coming here. Thank you for filling out that evaluation form. I want to thank Wendy Yalowitz and the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation for getting us onto this topic with this audience, and ask you to join me in thanking the panel for an incredibly good discussion.
There was one I saw about Minnesota's shrinking.
We actually don't usually do it, but I'd love to be able to circulate all these questions.
I'm interested in what they raised.